Translation. When chastised by Lord Chaitanya, I was very happy to receive a punishment similar to that awarded Sri Mukunda. Purport. Sri Mukunda, a great friend and associate of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, used to visit many places where people were against the Vaishnava cult. When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to know of this, he punished Mukunda, forbidding him to see him again. Although Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was soft like a flower, he was also strict like a thunderbolt. And everyone was afraid to allow Mukunda to come again into the presence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mukunda, therefore, being very sorry, asked his friends whether he would one day be allowed to see Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When the devotees brought this inquiry to Lord Chaitanya, the Lord replied, Mukunda will get permission to see me after many millions of years. When they gave this information to Mukunda, he danced with jubilation. And when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu heard that Mukunda was so patiently waiting to meet him after millions of years, he immediately asked him to return. There is a statement about the punishment of Mukunda in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, Madhya Kanda, 10th chapter. So in Chaitanya Lila, we have this, it's a delight to be back here again. And I want to give you all a disclaimer that I can't guarantee anything that I say this morning that has any merit whatsoever, since I've only gotten 2 hours of sleep and I'm jet lagged as all get out. So just be warned, okay? So, Chaitanya Lila is filled with these interactions with Mahaprabhu Gauranga. Very, very colorful. Very delightful to read. Because these are the ways in which devotees are interacting with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, who we have to remember is himself the embodiment of the love between Radha and Krishna. So this is not an ordinary interaction with someone. Even as amazing and marvelous and unique as Vaishnavas are, it's not even an interaction with a Vaishnava. It is an interaction with the very embodiment of the love between Radha and Krishna. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Radha Krishna Nahi Anya. That Mahaprabhu is none other than Radha Krishna combined. We have a very special tradition, the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. Prabhupada tells us that bhakti is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Bhakti is there, present in all religious traditions. He says this very plainly in the books. He says, all true religion possesses bhakti. So when I teach world religions and my degree, as Shruti Dharma mentioned, is from Harvard University. I don't know if any of you have heard, that's a small school in the States. Yeah, I know you have Cambridge here and Oxford and all that, but you know we have schools there too. So my degree, my PhD, is literally religionum comparationum, comparative religion. And Prabhupada desired that a few of us would become truly experts in comparative religion. He wanted us to show that bhakti is there present in every genuine tradition. So one of the nicest and appreciative comments I got in anonymous student reviews of courses. You know, every semester they hand out anonymous reviews to be filled out by students on how they like the course, how they like the professor, and so on. So one time a student said, whenever Dr. Schweig teaches us about Islam, we think he's a Muslim. Whenever Dr. Schweig teaches us about Christianity, we think he's a Christian. And whenever he teaches us about Buddhism, we think he's a Buddhist. I have the most problem with that one. And so on. And someone last night was asking me, so when you teach these traditions, don't students ever come up to you and ask you, what do you follow? What is your tradition? And I said, yeah, quite a bit they come up. And so he asked me, so what do you say? And I said, that is a secret. I said, I want you to figure out what speaks to you. Because you see, I have faith that if bhakti is identified in every tradition, that this will bring out the bhakti in one's heart that is naturally there. You know, sometimes we devotees, you know, we think that we have to sort of, you know, slam people with Krishna bhakti. No, just the opposite. Just bring it out. It's already there. And when we work with that presupposition, it's amazing what comes out of people. Maybe I once told you the story about when I went on a morning walk with Prabhupada. It was in, where was it? It wasn't in India. It wasn't Mayapur. I think it was in Dallas, Texas. And the devotees were excited to take Prabhupada to a park. Early in the morning. It was still dark out. So we all got into a few cars. Just there were not that many of us. Just a few cars, and we went barreling down the road for about 15 minutes to the park. And we got there to the parking lot, and we went walking toward the entrance of the park, and there was a sign with a gate saying, park closed, open at sunrise. So the devotees went, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I mean, you have no idea when devotees would make plans for Prabhupada, and then they just, you know, were like the wrong plans. I mean, it was a real, as we say in the United States, a freak out. I don't know if you say that here or not, but anyway, it's just like something, we freeze up. We don't know what to say to Prabhupada. So unfortunately, I was not one of those making the arrangements. So they said, Prabhupada, we didn't know the park was closed. And Prabhupada said, think nothing of it. We'll just walk up and down the parking lot. Prabhupada was so kind and accommodating. So there we were, walking up, and we would just walk to one end of the parking lot. And you could hear Prabhupada's cane, you know, clicking on the pavement, right? And then we'd all get to the end, and we'd just turn around. And the parking lot was not that big, you know? So we would just kind of go back and forth and back and forth for a good hour. Even when the gates opened, Prabhupada continued to go back and forth. It was sort of just a pattern that was kind of mesmerizing all of us, and we were engaged in conversation. And of course, so we would be engaged in periods of japa at times and periods of conversation. And since the park had opened, there was a jogger coming along. And he was coming right toward the whole group. Prabhupada was going toward him, and he was coming toward us. And, you know, he would sort of go on the side. So he was looking at all of us, a kind of strange sight to see. You know, all this sort of flowing cloth everywhere. And he was in his little shorts and a tiny little t-shirt. And Prabhupada said to him, "Good morning, sir." And he said, "Good morning to you all." And that was that. And I could tell what was going on in the minds of many devotees, like, Prabhupada didn't even say Hare Krishna. The process of Krishna bhakti is natural. And Prabhupada said, you know, in a television some media interview, when he was asked, how can you tell a Vaishnava? And he said, I think this was a Gainesville, Florida interview. He said, you can tell a Vaishnava by the fact that he is a perfect gentleman. And of course, a necessary corollary would be a gentle woman as well. And again, what an unexpected answer. I thought, you know, at the time, even when I was reading along, I thought, you know, well, there's the tilak, that should be pretty obvious, you know. And then we dress a little strangely too. So it's kind of obvious when you see a devotee. But Prabhupada understood and exemplified so well when Mahaprabhu describes that it is not philosophical arguments that make someone a devotee, or it's not the insistence on a philosophical vision or a worldview. Because he says, even Mahaprabhu says that even sages disagree on points of philosophy. Great sages, he says. But it is the behavior of a Vaishnava that establishes the principles of religion. So it's the behavior. Yeah, in the old days, the Sunday feasts were really wild. They were quite wild because, you know, back in the early 70s, you never knew who was going to come to the Sunday feast. It was really a strange experience. So I was in the Washington, D.C. temple. Washington, D.C. is a city in the States. At one time, you know, you Brits wanted the United States. You realize that, right? Right, but you couldn't have it. We wouldn't let you have it. Okay? So we've developed things since then. Anyway, whatever. You have so much history here, you don't have room for hours. In any case, the ISKCON history is always interesting. So I was there, you know, the temple was downtown at the time. Not in the suburbs like it is now, But I sat down next to someone. Looked like a nice enough young man. I was a young man. And I said to him, good evening. Are you enjoying the feast? Are you enjoying the program? And he said, yes, very much. I said, what is your name? I said that to him. He said, I'm God. I said, excuse me? He said, I am God. You're God. He said, yes, I am God. I mean, he declared it three times. Which, as you know, is a very powerful declaration. I said, do you know how long I have been waiting to meet you? I have been waiting a long time to meet you. May I sit down? And I really want to get to know you. He said, most certainly. So I got to know God. And he was a very nice gentleman. Eventually, he came to understand a little bit more what God is, but he just had some delusions of grandeur, this gentleman. And we go through these things every once in a while, and that's okay. And even if someone comes to our temple where we worship God, and they claim to be God, that's okay. We let God stay. It's not a problem. But I've seen some devotees get terribly incensed with that. But a devotee is a Kripa Sindhu, right? A devotee is Kripa Sindhu. Well, if it's not a Sindhu, maybe just a Bindu, huh? A little drop is good. You know, recently I've been going up to devotees and asking them if they are truly an ocean of grace. Because if they are, I have a lot I want to express. Most of the time they really say that they're not. And I said, well, don't you say that Vanchakalpa thing? Don't you say that? So are we expecting everyone else to be that ocean and not us? I mean, where does that go? So Kripa Bindu, I suggest we might want to change that to Kripa Bindu just tentatively, and then change it later. You know, when we see more of the oceans around. Yeah. But so when we approach people, we bring out their hearts by the way we can be so loving and compassionate and understanding to them. This is the idea. You know, this is the idea. So I think that if we approach people with the presupposition that Krishna is residing in their hearts and that they are bhaktas but unconscious bhaktas. But when I say bhakta, I don't necessarily mean as one of us, specifically practicing Krishna bhakti. It could mean that they are ready for bhakti in any number of traditions. Even in India, there are many bhakti traditions within the Hindu complex of traditions. So what is special about our form of bhakti? What is special? Why don't we just all like leave right now and go to another bhakti, you know, tradition within Indian traditions? You want to go, Swamiji? Oh, you don't? Good. Oh, you want to answer my question? Please. Okay, Lord Chaitanya. Okay, yes, that is exactly right. But what about Lord Chaitanya is making our form of bhakti so very special? Who is Mahaprabhu? Well, we said earlier, he is Radha Krishna Nahi Anya, right? None other than Radha Krishna. He is the embodiment of Mahabhava. Okay. He is the embodiment of the greatest and most intense form of loving Krishna. And Radha herself is the embodiment of Mahabhava. So the only two people that ever get to have Mahabhava is Radha and Mahaprabhu, right? So what does that have to do with us, though? I mean, what is our relationship to that Mahabhava? So in the book that I finished for Tamal Krishna Goswami, published by Oxford University Press, you may remember a few years ago, 4 years ago, I think, I came here and when the book was unveiled and so on. But in the last chapter, I finished the book, I explain there that Mahaprabhu, as the embodiment of Mahabhava, has a personality in Chaitanya Lila that is very intense. He's very intensive. And you can see that here in this this punishment of Mukunda? A million years? What is it? He was strict like a thunderbolt, right? Yes, after many millions of years, not just a million years. Okay, let's get the numbers straight. After many millions of years, he would not be able to have the audience of Mahaprabhu. Now, I don't understand these devotees like Mukunda who dance and in jubilation at that. Myself, I think I would faint and fall flat and just die. But with jubilation. And because Mukunda showed such appreciation that he would eventually get the audience of Mahaprabhu, Mahaprabhu himself was so impressed with that. He said, so bring him in. Vaishnavas are extraordinarily appreciative and grateful souls. And what makes us, what allows us to be so grateful? What is special about this tradition, as Swamiji said, Mahaprabhu, and the embodiment of Mahabhava? Well, in thinking about Mahaprabhu's intensity and extreme behaviors of his inability to contain his love for Krishna, his inability to contain his ecstasy, to the point where he would just be, he shouldn't have been in a body. He couldn't even contain his body. Everyone was maintaining his body externally, his devotees. And then once a fisherman, you know, drew him out from the ocean in something that was unidentifiable as a human body. He couldn't understand what it was. He's a fisherman. Generally, they're good at identifying things. I mean, that's what they do. They, you know, this is a fish, that's a fish. This is, well, I don't know what this is. I mean, it couldn't be a human. It's not a fish. I don't know what it is. These extraordinary transformations, bodily transformations, were, again, exemplifying the intensity and uncontainable quality and power of the love he felt for Krishna. Really, he could not be in a body. And these sort of explosions of ecstasy would happen. And when writing this chapter in the book, you know, I was thinking of a proper metaphor for Mahaprabhu, and a devotee suggested that I utilize the metaphor that Sridhar Maharaj uses, that of a volcano. Now, volcano is an okay metaphor in the sense that it's eruptive, right? But when's the last time you heard of anyone running toward a volcano? If you run too close to a volcano, you know what happens? You get incinerated because of the lava, the red hot lava. So a volcano is not the greatest metaphor, because Mahaprabhu is someone you run toward. He's irresistibly attractive. So a volcano, I mean, if a volcano happened out here, I think we'd all run in the other direction. I really do. Trust me. You know, we'd probably take we'd just take everything and just run the other direction. So the idea then is that he's more of a geyser that erupts. When the earth erupts in these beautiful fountains of magnificent mineral water that's fresh and purifying and beautiful, Mahaprabhu is like a geyser. And the spray from the Mahabhava of Mahaprabhu as a geyser forms pools of water in which we get to bathe. It's probably my mother. I'll talk to her later. That is what's special about our sampradaya. Our form of bhakti is that we get to bathe in the spray and in the pools of water formed by the spray from the geyser of Mahabhava. We get to come so close to that. And that is why we chant the Panchatattva mantra before the Maha mantra. Because what we are effectively doing is bathing in that spray before we chant the Maha mantra. So just remember that before you commence with a round of the Maha mantra, you're bathing first in, she's very insistent, I understand, bathing in that spray of Mahabhava. That is what distinguishes our tradition from all other bhakti traditions. It's not that we're saying that you shouldn't be in other bhakti traditions. We're not saying that. Prabhupada himself didn't say that. He said, if you are a Muslim, then really delve deeply and sincerely into the Islamic tradition. If you are a Christian, then delve deeply into that tradition. And you will find bhakti. Prabhupada, I never heard Prabhupada say that to anybody, but I believe that's what he meant. You will find the bhakti. I recall the verse before, the one we read today. Where Advaitacharya was claiming to expound on the Yoga Vasishta. And he did so to make Mahaprabhu angry. I think that's hilarious. I think that's absolutely hilarious. I mean, I should go up to Shruti Dharma later today and say, Prabhuji, I'm reading Shankaracharya's Sharirakam Mimamsa Bhashya. I'm really loving it. I mean, I don't think he would give me quite the welcome he did earlier today. Or maybe he would. He'd say, so today we're very fortunate to have Garuda Prabhu here, and he is reading the Sharirakam Mimamsa Bhashya of Shankaracharya, and he'd like to share that all with you. I mean, maybe he would do that. But I don't think so. I don't think so. The Yoga Vasishta. So these different interactions with Mahaprabhu, each one is unique. And in many ways inscrutable. Difficult to understand. But remember that Mahaprabhu is the embodiment of Mahabhava. It's very intense. The interactions are very intense. Because how do you come close to a geyser? If you come too close to the geyser, it will knock you down. And in many ways, these close associates of Mahaprabhu get knocked down. Like millions of years, you cannot see me. He got very close to that geyser. And when that geyser pops out, you get knocked down. It's very powerful. So when we read the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we have to be prepared to hear about very intensive experiences. Mahaprabhu, in encountering intellectuals, also had extreme experiences, right? There were extreme experiences there with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He listened to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya for 7 days and seven nights. I don't know about any of you, but I mean, when I encountered God back in 72, I listened to him for about 20 minutes. That was plenty. But God can listen for 7 days and seven nights. So there's a difference. 7 days and seven nights. I listened to my God for 20 minutes, and that seemed to pretty much exhaust him. The other thing was extraordinary is that Sarvabhauma could speak for 7 days and seven nights. That was pretty extraordinary. And he is known historically of being a great Nyaya logician. This is one of the personalities that historians have been able to verify, you know, very strictly. He did, you know, live then. He was a very accomplished logician, very powerful thinker. So he did have a lot to say. My fellow, my God, he was not so sophisticated. He had some things to say, some rather exaggerated self-aggrandizement. But I pretty much exhausted him after 20 minutes, and then we really had a good conversation. But Mahaprabhu was able to do that with Prakashananda Saraswati. He acted in a peculiar way, as a normal sannyasi. He sat in the foyer, which is usually considered an unclean place. And yet his effulgence was so bright and so amazing, so brilliant and so beautiful. He melted the heart of Prakashananda Saraswati. And then when he encountered Keshava Kashmiri Pandit, in debating conventions of Sanskrit poetics and interpretation of a verse, he gave him endless permutations of interpretations. Amazing. So again, these are intensive leelas, all to demonstrate this geyser of Mahabhava. So the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I'll just finally say that the Chaitanya Charitamrita is such an important text for all of us to know, to read. Because it gives us the lens by which to appreciate the Bhagavata and the Bhagavad Gita. Both the Bhagavata and the Bhagavad Gita are quoted throughout the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And again, it gives us the lens by which we can really appreciate deeply what is going on in the Bhagavata. But remember that the Chaitanya Charitamrita was also written in a certain time, in a certain desha of kala desha patra, time, place, and circumstance. We as devotees have the charge of explaining the Chaitanya Charitamrita for current readers. That is our job, to make our beautiful, beautiful theology of Krishna Bhakti accessible to modern readers. We have to use the language of the day, the idiomatic expressions, the conventions of English and or other languages. We have to bring these great pieces of literature into the foreground, in a sense, to translate them. Even though this is translated, we still have to translate it. It's in English, but we have yet to translate it even further into English. We have yet to really understand the amazing gifts that Prabhupada brought us. We have yet to really, really mine the jewels and to show the world what great gifts we have to offer. We have yet to do this. One thing I really enjoy doing in working with Naveen Krishna Prabhuji, with the Avanti schools, is that there we're forced to define what are the great gifts that we have to offer. We're forced. We have to. It's an urgent situation. In the temples, we can get really comfortable, you know? Oh, who cares about giving out the gifts? I mean, here's Radha and Krishna, Sitaram, Lakshman, Hanuman. I mean, why do I have to do anything else? I mean, I'm in heaven here. I was just in Vrindavan, and I told everyone there that I met, I said, you're very spoiled. And all the Brajbasi devotees in our temple there, I said, you're very spoiled. I went up to Panchagota, the president. I said, you're very spoiled. You live here all the time. Although he goes 5 months to the west, and then he comes back 7 months, he explained. But But basically, his home is in Vrindavan. He said, you're very spoiled. But don't forget what we have to do. We have to make available these precious jewels of the tradition. We have to be able to enter into conversation with some of the most sophisticated theologians in other traditions. We have to match them in sophistication. This is not an easy thing to do, but we must strive to do that. Otherwise, we'll simply become anachronistic. We'll become out of date. We'll become some little preservation of a tradition, some little anomaly, some little interesting museum-like thing to come visit. Like, oh, look at them. Well, that's interesting. No, this is something to be lived, to be enacted, to affect change in the world. This is the next frontier, to translate what Prabhupada already translated. That's what we have to do. This is the next frontier. That's what I said to a bunch. I was a keynote speaker to educators all from around the world, met in Houston. And I did it over Skype because I could not attend. But the title of my talk was very obnoxious, as I am prone to being at times. The title of the talk was, "You Can't Teach What You Don't Know." : The next frontier. You can't teach what you don't know. If we don't know what the jewels are of our tradition in a succinct fashion, then we can't give that to others. So this is what we need to work on. This is what I enjoy working with, Naveen Krishnaji. Urgent matter. So I'll just stop there and open up for any questions or comments. Again, my disclaimer, I can't claim any authenticity of anything I've said because I am basically in a jet lag trance. I'm in trance, so I have no idea what has been said in the last 40 minutes. But still, if you have any comments or questions to add, Swamiji, yes. Question is, what is the process for mining these jewels and distributing these jewels? As the Gita says, we are all kshetragyas. We are all knowers of our fields. Each of us have fields, arenas of interaction in which we act all the time, right? Every field has its peculiarities, its qualities, its persons involved. We need to really know our fields, literally and figuratively. We need to know who is it that's within our realm of interaction. Now, for myself, I'm an educator. So I'm speaking with other PhDs around the world. I speak at universities. I spoke at the University of Mumbai recently, the Sanskrit department. Spoke to them about Bhagavad Gita. I showed them how and why the Gita is unquestionably a bhakti text. Unquestionably. This is not up for debate anymore. Although in the academics, everything's always up for debate. But, you know. I was jet-lagged there, too, so I probably said some obtuse things and probably glad I said them because they would be along that line of thinking. We need to know what our fields are. The field could be your children and people connected to your children, like teachers in your school or friends or neighbors. That could be your field, sure. It's a field of interaction. Since my field is the academics, any neighbors I have, I just ignore. No, I don't. I'm nice to them. I go out and I talk to them. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not that bad. But seriously, define what your field is. Who is in that realm of yours? And then figure out exactly how I can communicate with them and what gifts can I draw from. Machitta magata prana bodhyanta parasparam. So first we've got to connect deeply in our own selves with Krishna. Okay, machitta, right, with our own awareness. And then we come out bodhyanta parasparam. Then we're interacting with one another. Then we can enlighten each other. It's not just us enlightening those in your field, but those in your field can enlighten you about what's truly important to them. Find out what is ultimately valuable to them in their lives, appropriate to that field. Now, I don't walk up to, you know, colleagues of mine in the academic realm, other PhDs from Harvard and Chicago and all these places, and say, hey, Professor so-and-so, what is really ultimately valuable to you? I don't do that. But I have had thoughts of doing that, to be perfectly honest. Sometimes I wonder why some of my colleagues have gone to all the trouble of getting a doctorate and even master's degrees. Do you know what it's like to go through that? Hell. Hell, ladies and gentlemen. Hell on earth. Such tapas, such energy, years and years and years of one's life devoted to this, and they're not even bhaktas, and they're studying our tradition after so many years. I wonder, who are these people? Well, Ravindra Swarup has a theory, a good friend of mine. He says, they were bhaktas in the last life, but they performed so many offenses that they became scholars in this life, just like you. That's his response. So, we have to really get to know our field. Part of getting to know our field is really listening. You know, our first process is shravanam. Do we really take that process seriously? Hearing everywhere. Do we hear others? Do we hear what makes their hearts tick, you know? Do we hear what's valuable to them? Are we sensitive to the thoughts and feelings of others? Or are we just too self-absorbed to where we have to impose on them what we like without being sensitive to whether there's any reception on their part? Get to know your field. Then you will know how to deliver the jewels. But in the meantime, we have to mine the jewels. And that has to do with sadhana. That has to do with bathing your mind and your heart in the Maha Mantra, with the Panchatattva Mantra. Don't forget about the geyser, the waters, the spray that we get to be showered under. It's a powerful tradition. It's good, is it? It's good? Swamiji said perfect. I have no idea what I just said because I'm largely unconscious right now. I'm really much nicer when I'm, you know, when I get the proper amount of sleep. I really am. Any other comments or questions? Yes.